policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing, too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. All 24 lodges in the world are united by the principles contained in the Declaration. Yet each is independent and free to determine how frequently it will meet, wherever they are located, to disseminate these ideas to others. Here in Philadelphia, there are two weekly meetings, a weekly discussion group, reference library, and a small bookstore table where straight line theosophical materials may be purchased before and after meetings. These items may be downloaded at no cost at the United Lodge of Theosophists, Phoenix, Arizona website. On Wednesday evenings, the reference library is open from 5:15 to 7:15. For those who want to browse and discover where their intuition leads them, for those who wish to do a more focused, independent kind of study, and of course for those who want to study and read Wednesday night's assignment. The doors to the library close at 7:15, which is 15 minutes before the start of the 7:30 to 8:30 study class. We are studying Reincarnation in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And on this Wednesday, we will begin studying Chapter 10. On Fridays, the discussion group meets in the evenings from 5:15 to 7:15 in the reference library. On Sunday mornings, the building opens at 10:30 for the 11 to 12 meeting, which will be in the form of a lecture, a panel, or forum discussion. An umbrella topic is selected each month, and various aspects are emphasized and discussed. For January, the topic was The Path of Spiritual Evolution. This series began with a talk entitled The Power of Intention and Will, and concluded last week with a talk on The Path of Mahayana Buddhism. February's umbrella is Nobel and Noble Theosophical Voices, which is a description of what the four voices, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King Jr., and Albert Schweitzer have in common. In March, five aspects of the umbrella topic, The Mystery of Mind, will be presented. The series will begin on the first Sunday with Intelligence in the Lower Kingdoms, and will conclude on the fifth Sunday with the topic Raja Yoga Aphorisms. All theosophical work done at the lodge is done by volunteers in terms of time, resources, and work. The opportunity to volunteer is open to anyone who wishes to help disseminate these ideas. If interested in helping in any way, please speak with the person at the book table. Now for a reading for today. In The Key to Theosophy, H.P. Blavatsky wrote, "In our opinion, Father Damien, the young man of 30 who offered his whole life in sacrifice for the benefit and alleviation of the sufferings of the lepers at Molokai, and who went to live for 18 years alone with them to finally catch the loathsome disease and die, has not died in vain. He has given relief and relative happiness to thousands of miserable wretches. He has brought to them consolation, mental and physical. He threw a streak of light into the black and dreary night of an existence, the hopelessness of which is unparalleled in the records of human suffering. He was a true theosophist, and his memory will live forever in our annals. Had we the means to do so, we would raise a statue to Father Damien, the true, practical saint, and perpetuate the memory of this poor Belgian priest forever as a living exemplar of theosophical heroism and of Buddha and Christ-like mercy and self-sacrifice. When we look at the life and work of Mother Teresa, we recognize that this Catholic nun would have received the same accolade as Father Damien. The talk today, Mother Teresa, the saint of Calcutta.
We think to even look at a picture of Mother Teresa, you can see the compassion and the love for humanity. She took no pride in herself. Obviously, if she was going to end up dressed as the poorest of the poor in India, she had no vanity. We apologize for the fact that we will be doing a lot of reading because this is a talk that is mostly fact that doesn't allow us to experience the humor and wisdom of Mother Teresa herself. However, that can certainly come out in the questions. Perhaps one of the most theosophical of all her words, although it's really hard to choose, it is certainly not what one would expect of a Catholic nun. She wrote, "I'm not asking you to be a Catholic. I'm asking you to be a better Hindu, or a better Muslim, or a better Protestant, or a better Catholic, or a better Parsi, or a better Sikh, or a better Buddhist. And after you have found God, it is up to you to do what God wants you to do." She wanted people to come closer to God, however they understood God, and believed that in this way they would learn to come closer to each other, love one another, and ultimately create a world that is better for everyone to live in. That's the same goal that all great teachers have had, but she never saw herself as a teacher, but a very humble servant. The words. What she created was a group called the Missions of Charity. And the Missions of Charity stated as part of their principles, "We shall not impose our Catholic faith on anyone. but have profound respect for all religions. That's a wonderful theosophical statement. And again, not what you would expect from a Catholic nun who has had her missionaries approved by the Pope. Now, there are many things that are claimed to be said by Mother Teresa, but there is a website that, if you are curious about a quote, motherteresa.org, where you can see if it was actually said by her. We're going to hand out a quote sheet after the meeting, and we let one of those quotes that wasn't hers get by. We'll see if you can figure out what it is. She is widely known and widely respected, winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979. She died in September 1997, and from the efforts of that compassionate soul, leaving for the world her work to be carried on, we still have, as of 2015, it's counted every 5 years, we still have active contemplative sisters numbering 5,150 in 139 countries, active brothers at 391 in 21 countries, contemplative brothers at 48 in 5 countries, and 35 priests in 5 countries. All these started by one very tiny woman with complete faith and belief in God and compassion and its power. She was Albanian, born in Yugoslavia in 1910 to a very religious Catholic family. She was herself a very mystical child with deep love of Christ, of God, for to her, the two were one and the same. If you said Christ or you said God, it was the same thing. She wrote, "I was only 12 when I first knew I had a vocation to the poor." She always dreamed of going to India, of becoming a missionary. It's rather impossible for a young Albanian, you would think. Her mother told her, as she left to become a nun, "Put your hand in Jesus's hand and walk alone with him." At the age of 18, she joined the Sisters of Loreto, L-O-R-E-T-O, an Irish community of nuns with missions in India and primarily dedicated to education. After a few months of training in Dublin, she was sent to Calcutta, India, where in May of 1931, she took her initial vows as a nun. From that day in 1931 to 1948, Mother Teresa taught at St. Mary's High School in Calcutta, was part of the Loreto Sisters' mission. In the words of Mother Teresa, "Every Sunday where there wasn't school, I would visit in the poor in Calcutta's slums. I cannot help them because I do not have anything, but I go to them to give them joy. They have nothing, but I saw they were very happy because I visit them. One mother said to me, 'Oh, Ma, come again. Your smile brought sun into this house.'" In 1946 in Calcutta, there was great unrest. There was a Hindu-Muslim conflict going on, and it caused an extreme shortage of food for even the wealthiest people. Mother Teresa was then the principal of St. Mary's and therefore had 300 girls directly under her supervision and no food. She did what few would do. She left the building and was shocked to discover the streets were full of dead rioters. They could hear the noise from inside the high school, but they didn't know there was such violence going on. But she didn't care. She kept going on her search for food. A lorry full of soldiers stopped when they saw her and said, "Go back, take shelter." She said, "No, I can't. I have 300 girls to feed. I can't." So they said, "Well, we have some rice." So they drove her back to the school and unloaded the bags of rice, and therefore they had food. She often put her life at risk that way, but she didn't see it that way. She just did what needed to be done and didn't pay any attention to the fact that she might be harmed, because she couldn't go against her own heart, her own hope to heal people. In September 1946, this was a significant point in her life, she was sent for a needed rest at the Laredo convent in Darjeeling. While on the train, she had a mystical experience with Christ. She heard distinctly a voice in her head that asked her, in Mother Teresa's own words, "Give up even Laredo, where I was very happy, and go out in the street to serve the poorest of the poor." It was on that train I heard the call to give up all and follow Christ into the slums, to serve him in the poorest of the poor. I knew it was his will, and I had to follow him. There was no doubt that it was going to be his work. Jesus said, "Come, be my light. Carry me into the holes of the poor. Dress in simple Indian clothes, simple and poor." The very thought of a nun wearing a poor sari and living the life of the Indian poor while serving them was a shocking thing. But Mother Teresa was persuaded that this was a truly divine calling. Now, mind you, at that time, nuns everywhere wore the simple black and white with the hood. To be other than that was not to be a nun. So this idea and this persuasion of hers was very peculiar. She told her superiors of her calling to God, Christ, in this manner, and asked permission to do so in 1946. Now, her father confessor that she saw all the time already knew how sincere and devoted and obedient Mother Teresa was, and was all for having her do what she wanted to do. But he felt that one did not make these kinds of decisions overnight, that it required meditation and great thought for the future. Eventually, he, along with giving permission to Mother Teresa to do it, wrote to the Archbishop of Calcutta, telling him of her experience and what she hoped to be able to do based on that. In 1948, it took 2 years, after much persuasion on her part and much examination of her plans and her nature, those authorities were convinced that she did indeed seek help for the poor and not herself. During this time, she stressed whatever those above her decided, she would take that as an absolute order. If they said no, she would not go against her vow as a nun to be obedient. When you stop and think about that, that was probably the greatest sacrifice of her life, having that fire within her to obey what God wanted of her, and yet be willing to say, I made a vow as a nun, and I will be obedient to that if you say I can't do this. During this time, she waited impatiently. And if you read any of her writings, she really nagged them. She gave a constant reminder of, I'm waiting for your answer. And the priest and the archbishop, is that how you say it? Thought that it was moving along very quickly. It was already under the consideration of the Pope, and it was moving very quickly, but she didn't see it that way. She wanted to get permission to leave the convent school and devote herself to working in the slums of Calcutta. Again, in her words, to carry Christ into the homes and streets of the slum, among the sick, dying, the beggars, and the little street children. The sick will be nursed as far as possible in their poor homes. The little children will have a school in the slums. Now, we don't know if you've ever read anything about the slums, which still have this problem today, but there was nothing, absolutely nothing, because that's what they were to the rest of India, nothing. So there were no schools, there was no hospital, no care for them physically or spiritually. And that is what she intended to do, both. If you are sick, you get nursing. If you then get well, you get teaching, but not teaching in the sense of the Catholic dogma, but teaching in the sense of you are worth something to God, and therefore so is the person next to you. It was very theosophical. The beggars will be sought and visited in their holes outside the town or on the streets to bring souls to God and God to souls. She, while they were, once they made their decision, she was to remain outside the cloister for 1 year, after which the Archbishop of Calcutta would decide whether she should continue with this new work or return to the Sisters of Loreto. She was allowed to give up her standard black and white nun's habit and to dress in a simple sari. The one she designed, white with three blue stripes, was similar to those worn by the women of the poor who swept the streets. So she adopted a religious dress that was both simple and practical and symbolical. It not only helped to identify with the poor, but it was also much more suitable to Calcutta's searing climate. She never, ever wore anything else until she died. Donning the blue and white sari that she would wear in public for the rest of her life, she left the convent and wandered out into the city. After 6 months of basic medical training, she voyaged for the first time into Calcutta's slums with no more specific a goal than to aid the unwanted, the unloved, the uncared for. In packing up and leaving in this manner, she didn't get to say goodbye to a lot of her students, and she was then the principal of the high school, so her fellow teachers, and she left with only 5 rupees. Now, in 1948, That was probably worth about $1.50. But she trusted completely in God's will, in this divine impression. She translated her calling into concrete actions to help the poor. She began an open-air school, established a home for the dying destitute in a dilapidated building. She convinced the city government to donate to her cause. Although she had no funds, she depended on divine providence. Soon she was joined by voluntary helpers, and financial support started coming in. It made it possible for her to extend the scope of her work. In October 1950, she won recognition for a new congregation, the Missionaries of Charity, which she founded with only a handful of members, most of them former teachers or pupils from St. Mary's School. Now we have to realize how significant that is. These are dedicated, faithful nuns that turned around and gave up all to be reduced to the poorest of the poor, to live on dirt floors and work in the humblest conditions. Mother Teresa's work has been recognized and acclaimed throughout the world. I think if you say the name Mother Teresa anywhere in the world, people will know who you're talking about. She has received a number of awards and distinctions. In addition to the Nobel Peace Prize, she received the Pope John the 23rd Peace Prize in 1971 and the Nehru Prize for her promotion of international peace and understanding in 1972. She envisioned a congregation of women and received her first companion in March 1945. The Little Society of 12 members was officially established October 1950. The religious branches now include the Sisters, the Brothers, the Contemplative Sisters, the Contemplative Brothers, and the Fathers. For all of the Sisters, Brothers, and Fathers, Mother Teresa is Mother. So we have the work of one soul who heard God, Christ, ask for her help to bring his love and compassion to the poorest of the poor, herself afraid to live in such a manner, but willing to serve as she was asked to do. And she continued in her simple sari of her own design, even wearing it to accept the Nobel Prize. There are two books credited as the writings of Mother Teresa. We just forgot one name. It's like Crisis of the Soul, Crisis of Faith of the Soul. And the other one is Come Be My Lamp. In both cases, it represents, in my opinion, a sort of tragedy that they had no right to do what they did. Some were letters to her father confessor, but not in the confession, so of course they were open, and to the Archbishop of Calcutta. In both cases, she had written that she wanted the letters back, that they didn't mean anything to anyone but her, and she wanted them back. The father confessor said, no, they represent the start of the missionaries of charity, and therefore they're historical. And the archbishop felt the same way. Fine. She wanted them destroyed, they wanted them kept and preserved. Fine. Unfortunately, those two books contain all of those letters, which I don't know, they make people read them and wonder because they don't understand how could a soul who was writing of the darkness in her own heart and feeling that she couldn't reach God, that she had perhaps disappointed him, and that she didn't want to do what she'd been asked to do because she wouldn't be any good at it. She wasn't smart enough, she wasn't good enough, she wasn't wise enough. And people don't understand when someone complains that way while doing great charity. And we feel it was not fair to her that they published those letters and then made the books look as though she must have wanted it because they gave her credit as the author of these books. So you can read them and decide for yourself, but we think better to just read about her life and not how she felt about it. Now, if you have questions, we're not sure we can answer them, but we have many quotes we can answer from. Yes.
We had heard a number of years ago after she passed that, now we don't know if it was true or if it just came, you know, somebody spreading false rumors about her, that she actually had a crisis of faith.
Yes, that's what that book is called.
Oh, so that's what that's.
Oh, it's genuine.
Okay.
And she had, the doubts she had were not about God or Christ or the charity that she was the head of and the director of. It was about herself. I guess it would be like anyone reaching way over their head in order to do something, because she could speak Albanian, Serbian, French, and a little English when she started this and had to learn as she went along. She did not feel like God did a very smart thing in picking her. And because she felt that way, she spent all her, I don't know, perhaps devotional hours wondering why God wasn't speaking to her now, had she disappointed him that much. So that's what the book is called, Crisis of Faith. Yes?
Regarding the title of this talk, was she actually ever canonized as a saint?
That's just very recent. Very recent.
Do we know the basis, how she earned?
Well, that supposedly two miracles, which of course we can't go into. That's a Catholic Church decision. But she went, they took it through the whole entire process of canonizing. Yes.
We are assuming it has to do with healing.
But that was from a medical standpoint.
Right. So we do recall that HPB speaks of a number of holy individuals, saints and so forth,
mm-hmm.
who because of, and others, who because of the holiness
right.
of their lives,
were able
even
to
without
heal.
Knowledge, were mm-hmm. able to perform wondrous things. You can call them miracles.
Right.
It put them in touch with something in their nature which would not otherwise have been available.
We think it's a shame that they didn't reflect on the miracles she worked in the slums. Instead, they went with the usual healing thing. And there were two examples that were used, but we're not familiar with them. But she herself, she was always seen smiling, which is why the crisis of faith was so shocking to people because she did not reflect that sadness and that frustration with herself in her daily work and daily living. No one ever saw her upset or unhappy or frustrated or disrupted in her work. She was always a smiling, joyous person. So, yes.
One of the threads that we've noticed in the lives of all the individuals that will be highlighted this month is that they were exemplars of renunciation in some way, which is very theosophical.
Right.
Rather than liberation. What would you say was the main act of renunciation that characterized her life?
That's a wonderful question. Maybe others will have some ideas too. I would have said teaching, because she was a natural at it. But she always knew that she wanted to work with the poor. So renouncing, I don't like words that change just because they want to. Renouncing teaching was not that big a thing for her. I would think renouncing a way of life that was contemplative, work, and then back to contemplating, so you had actual devotion time was expected. And then that's all in a clean and beautiful convent and a beautiful location. To go from that, to renounce all of that, and to find yourself living on dirt floors, it's a remarkable transition. We think that might have been the hardest thing for her to renounce. Yes?
Well, it seems as though her devotion was so intense. It seemed like she was trying to definitely renounce her lower self and was trying to live in the higher in everything that she did. The whole idea of giving up the mundane and, you know, the sacred in the mundane, it just seemed like she was trying to live the highest she could and was giving up her personality.
I would counter that with, I think she was born with the understanding that the lower was just a useful thing to, you know, sort of carried you around physically so you could go places. I think she had probably renounced that before this life, to have that contact with Buddhi so that it was just flowing through. But it was a beautiful thing, yes.
There's two contradictions.
Okay.
Concept of God, as she keep on referring to, and that miracles. How would you explain those concepts in the light of Mother Teresa?
Okay, Mother Teresa didn't claim miracles; she claimed hard work, and love, and a smile, and being joyous around anyone in any condition. She probably did not accept the idea of miracles and knew that it was something that had a reason. It was happening because it was happening, because it was the will of the divine. There's also the fact that what she says, God, Christ, being all one thing, the highest concept spiritually that you can conceive of, and then an individual expressing that. Well, that is like Theosophy says about the Christ consciousness, that we are all one with that through universal mind, but we don't recognize it, so we don't act on it. So we think what she was saying was very theosophical, but in terms that we then reduce to a particular religion. She would have done what she did if she'd been any religion. We'll get back to you in a minute. Go ahead.
Well, in line just with that statement, HPB points out examples of individuals from all different religious mm-hmm. backgrounds who may not have theosophical views. It's not part of their monastic.
Right. But of their heart.
But they have that direct ray of Bodhi.
Right.
Coming through, and they voice it, theosophical.
Mm-hmm.
In spite, and they would be good in whatever religion
exactly.
they found themselves in.
Exactly. Shining with that light that's in all of us. Yes.
If you research the canonization, one of the cures was from 1998, having to do with cancer and meningitis. The second miracle cure was in 2008, having to do with abscesses and systemic infections. In both cases, Mother Teresa was off the scene, and this is a statement by an Orthodox hierarchy that using her picture and relics and little medallions that she had once worn, that these two individuals were cured without medicines. And one has to wonder, in view of the humility of this soul, what her commentary would be with these cases in 1998 and 2008.
Right. I think she'd be wise enough to say the theosophical idea, and that's that, oh, it was their faith that made them whole, not anything of Mother Teresa's or anybody else. We don't think she would have argued against it, but we think she would have made a remark. She had great respect for those above her, even if they were not as sort of spiritual or committed to compassionate work than she was. Yes?
Well, if we're saying that these individuals had a lighting up of Bodhi, so we're actually, what we're saying is it's the heart doctrine.
Yes.
It's
the natural experience.
Is really the principle on which this is all based. It's not
mm-hmm.
upon intellectual
exactly.
understanding, but it's upon the understanding of the heart.
We'd like to just read from the quotes that she had on love. And they're part of the quote list there. If we really want to love, we must learn how to forgive. The fruit of love is service, which is compassion in action. If you judge people, you have no time to love them. It is easy to love the people far away. It is not always easy to love those close to us. It is easier to give a cup of rice to relieve hunger than to relieve the loneliness and pain of someone unloved in our own home. Bring love into your home, for this is where our love for each other must start. Love begins by taking care of the closest ones, the ones at home. I prefer you make mistakes in kindness than work miracles in unkindness. So she had very definite views about the value of ourselves as individuals. Yes.
Of course, being a nun and being in the monastery, were you able to find quotes by her on the nature of prayer?
Yes. You can find everything except, like elephants and things like that. Everything that she was familiar with. Prayer, I should have told you, this is a quote from Theosophy. Prayer is not asking. Prayer is putting oneself in the hands of God, at his disposition, and listening to his voice in the depth of our hearts. Quite a different view on prayer. Her view on poverty. The most terrible poverty is loneliness and the feeling of being unloved. And that's what she brought to the poor. Some people come into our life as blessings. Some come in your life as lessons. Yes.
The prior quote about bringing love into the life of the poor.
Right.
Is it fair to say that as she was coming into the lives of these untouchables who were living with open sores in the
and dying in the street,
homes,
right?
Living on dumps, and we can't even imagine. What she was bringing them was an understanding of the true nature of self and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that they were emanations of the divine rather than being nothing.
Right.
Is that a fair...
Oh, my goodness, yes. She would have agreed with you. She would have said, well said. She gave through touch, through smiles, through her very presence. She literally did what was asked of her. She brought the divine into the slums. And it grew. I mean, there was a book a number of years ago about life in the slums by a young man who moved in and became part of the neighborhood of that slum. And how he realized somehow they had such a feeling of unity and caring for one another that it was quite beyond him, because it was the opposite of what he felt out in the real world. We don't remember the name of it. Yes.
Sometimes the perception of suffering and misery is a valuation made by those privileged. Observed, we've read that in direct contact with some of those people in the most miserable situations,
right.
When we think miserable, you find a profound contentment and happiness.
Yes.
And it's a tremendous lesson to the one witnessing it. So we wonder whether she brought the divine to them, or perhaps recognized it, helped bring it out.
Well, we think like any group of people, there's a percentage that are not in accord with that are bitter, perhaps. It, you know, it depends on their karma, how well they react to the situation. But I think it was both, that she honored the divine in them and making them feel it more, and that it had value, as well as bringing it to those who didn't have any sense of it. It's like that mother said, oh, come back, you brought the sun in here. They're not used to the sun. Poverty is a grinding thing. If you've ever experienced it, even in a small way, like going to bed hungry, you never forget it. You can't forget it. And you can therefore empathize more with someone else who's going through that. You know how they feel, how desperate they feel. We think what Mother Teresa did that was so startling, because many helpers go into the slums, and many have beautiful intentions, but they come from a better place, and they descend into the slum, do what they can, and then they go back to where they are, and it's that she descended and stayed there. She became living the life that they were living, just as Father Damien did, and therefore they recognized in her a fellow poor person. And if she could be poor like they were poor and shine with that divinity, well, then she was right. They must be able to shine that way if they only recognize it. Yes?
In addition to that, what we find most remarkable and the take-home message, so to speak, is she didn't try to get people to follow her path,
no.
To go out directly and sacrifice.
Right.
But she did say, find it within yourself and live it in your life the best way.
Right.
In other words, do your duty where you are. You don't have to be the saint of Calcutta, but even in the little ways of your life, you can live that life of compassion. A very strong message.
Yes, and she wouldn't want to be called the saint of Calcutta. She'd want to be called one of the poor. I was once asked why I don't participate in anti-war demonstrations. I said that I will never do that, but as soon as you have a pro-peace rally, I'll be there. She was not anti-war, she was pro-peace. She was not anti-rich people, she was just pro-poor people. She turned things around. This sounds like Mr. Judge. Be faithful in small things, because it is in them that your strength lies. Where is the one? At the moment of death, we will not be judged according to the number of good deeds we have done or by the diplomas we have received in our lifetime. We will be judged according to the love we have put into our work. Do not allow yourself to be disheartened by any failure as long as you have done your best. If you are humble, nothing will touch you, neither praise nor disgrace, because you know what you are. A servant of the divine. It's very simple. And I think it was that simplicity and dignity of her that in bringing that to the poor, it rubbed off on them. I do believe that. Yes.
We're reminded of the Bhagavad Gita,
mm-hmm.
where Krishna teaches, and HPB also talks about it, the charity, that not to give money or let someone else come
right.
between you and the benefit.
And the giving,
but
yeah.
give of yourself. And she makes the point that it doesn't just help the benefactor, but it brings out charitableness in the one receiving. Is there any account or indication in her work that the people that she helped this way became more charitable or more tolerant themselves? In other words, they just weren't helped in the sense of more food
right.
in their stomachs. But they
I don't think anyone went around and interviewed the poor. I think that what you could see was a change, perhaps, in that. But nobody was interested in the poor but Mother Teresa. So who was to be able to judge that? Although you could certainly see, like we remember pictures of her in the early 50s, sitting in the street with a dying person in her lap. Sort of like the Pietà of Mary holding her dying son, Jesus. That's just what it always reminded me of. But you could see in those pictures, she was totally there. She didn't care about the photographer. She didn't care about anything that was going on around her. She was there, giving that dying person who had nothing, who was just lying in the street, dying, no one caring. She was there for that person as a whole, her heart, her mind, her compassion. Right there, you know she changed that soul. She once wrote about holding a dying woman, and it was so moving to her that no one cared about this woman. And the woman looked up at her, and in her eyes and in her face, there was a smile of love, of thank you. And that moved Mother Teresa. She never got over that particular woman and how the exchange between them, the recognition of pure love that asks nothing back. Yes.
And in the mental images that you're inspiring, we still have to try to wrap our minds around a woman who left a pristine, protected, well-fed convent surrounded by art and music and literature and moved into this world of the untouchables where stench and germs and pre-antibiotics, there was no medicine, and every single custom left over that twisted perversion of the caste system that you don't touch outside your own caste and level. It's just a remarkable inspiration of selflessness.
And joy. Mm-hmm. You can see it. I have collected some photographs of her that just bring me so much pleasure, and then a sketch that someone did, and then Mother Teresa with children. Huh. She's beautiful, but if you really look at her features, no, she isn't. She's beautiful because her soul expresses itself in her eyes and in her smile. If, as you said, the takeaway from this, if we could do nothing but realize what she means by, if you want peace, bring peace into your own home. If you want love, love those around you. Learn from them, because if you can't get along with them, they're your lessons. If you can get along with them, they're the power and the strength you should use to bring into life for everyone else. Yes.
A companion study to this entire month, I guess, mm-hmm. would be Joseph Campbell's Masks of Deity, and it so parallels your opening remarks about be the best whatever.
Right.
You know, be a child of God, regardless of your understanding and expression
right.
of that. That would be a good companion reading.
And we can't recall the rabbi. We'll look it up now that we've done this. We cannot recall the rabbi who said, when I come to God, he's not going to ask anything. Like, were you as good as, were you the best at, as we're the best you could be? We could ask ourselves every night, was I the best I could be? And if not, take a message from it, learn from it. We can't necessarily give up all and do what Mother Teresa did for others, but we could certainly do it for those around us. So we invite you all to take the quotes and to come and hear next Sunday's talk on these noble and Nobel souls. Meeting is adjourned.